From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When the actor Laurence Olivier directed a film version of Hamlet in 1948, he included a preface that, for one sentence, diverged from the words of Shakespeare. He said, "This is the tragedy of a man who could not make up his mind." But not everyone agrees with this interpretation, that the Prince of Denmark is a paralyzed intellectual. Others have played him as more cunning, more determined. In fact, here's a twist on the idea from the movie The Last Action Hero.
Something is rotten in the state of Denmark, and Hamlet is taking out the trash.
To be or not to be. Not to be.
Today in the program, we're talking about Hamlet, about the play, about the characters, the story, and the way it's been performed over the years. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Like any of Shakespeare's tragedies, there's a lot going on in Hamlet. But on a basic level, you've got a very young man who's trying to make sense of his very strange home life. His father's been killed. His mother doesn't really waste any time in marrying his uncle, who a ghost has told him is the guy who did the deed. And now he has to figure out what to do. So the choice is action or something more measured, something thought out and contemplated. The scholar Eric Rasmussen says it's the same kind of decision voters have to make. Do they want men of action or someone who is more reflective? In fact, he says it's one of the biggest tensions in modern politics, but it's also something Shakespeare would have realized. The Utah Shakespeare Festival is staging a production of Hamlet this month, which is giving us an opportunity to talk about the themes in the play and the play itself. We'll talk about the characters, the story today, the performances. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. You can also join us on Facebook and on Twitter. Eric Rasmussen is with us. He is an English professor and the chair of the English department at the University of Nevada, Reno. He's also the curator of a website about Shakespeare's Hamlet. It's called Hamlet Works. He's joining us today from a studio in Reno. And Eric Rasmussen, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Delighted to be here.
We also have with us Marco Baricelli. He's the artistic director for Shakespeare Santa Cruz. He's directing the production of Hamlet for the Shakespeare Festival here in Utah. He has played the role of Hamlet in the past, by the way, and Baricelli is speaking to us from the campus of UC Santa Cruz. And Marco Baricelli, welcome to you. Thanks very much.
Very happy to be here. Thank you.
Well, let's do some introductions here first to get those who are maybe not entirely familiar with Hamlet. Eric Rasmussen, let's talk about, the basic introduction. It's fair to say Hamlet's a kind of angry, young man, maybe even a teenager. He's pretty sad. He's pretty upset. He's traumatized, I guess.
Well, he's very angry at the beginning, but he doesn't actually know why. He's upset that his father has died and his mother has married his uncle rather quickly thereafter. So in the opening of the play, he's sort of mad at the world, and particularly at his mother.
There's a scene here. In fact, I want to play this section. This is set this up for us, Eric, if you would. This is Derek Jacobi playing this particular particular scene, and as you say, he's not sure who to be mad at. He just knows he's upset.
Well, and it's Hamlet's first soliloquy. The play is structured around four major soliloquies for Hamlet. This is the first one. He's just encountered his uncle, and who's now king, and his mother, who's married to his uncle, in a very public court scene. And now the court is left, and this is the first time we hear Hamlet alone talking about his view of the world. And Shakespeare's soliloquies are much like writing for a diary. It's your private, inmost thoughts that you're telling the audience. And frequently actors playing Hamlet will speak directly to the audience. The audience is their friend. They're taking the audience into their confidence.
Here's Derek Jacobi.
Oh, that this too solid flesh would melt, thaw, and resolve itself into a dew. Although the everlasting had not fixed his canon against self-slaughter. Oh, God. God, how weary, stale, flat, and unprofitable seem to me all the uses of this world. Fie and oh, fie. 'Tis an unweeded garden that grows to seed. Things rank and gross in nature possess it merely. That it should come to this. But 2 months dead. Nay, not so much, not two. So excellent a king that was to this, Hyperion to a satyr. So loving to my mother, that he might not beteem the winds of heaven visit her face too roughly. Heaven and earth, must I remember? Why, she would hang on him as if increase of appetite had grown by what it fed on. And just within a month. Let me not think on. Frailty, thy name is woman.
Marco Baricelli, he's pretty despairing. I mean, the world is weary and stale and flat. It's an unweeded garden. He doesn't think, but he's in general despair.
Well, I would say that's true. I think anybody who's lost a parent probably feels that sort of sense of being unmoored and is angry at something and wants a place to put that anger. I think it's a very common, understandable feeling. And add to that the fact that his mother has, in a short amount of time, you know, too short in his estimation, married his uncle.
Yeah.
So I think at this point in the play, there is nobody seems to have any sense, of course, that Claudius is the culprit. But he, you know, this is a young man who has just lost his father and watched his mother do this very inappropriate thing in his eyes.
Yeah. Eric Rasmussen, where does the story come from? Shakespeare often, some would say mostly, got his ideas from other concepts. Where does this story come from? Do we know?
This is a Danish legend about Hamlet, and most of the elements of the story are there. Shakespeare invents a few things, but generally what Shakespeare brings to his work is not the plot per se, but the language.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes he will play on the audience thinking they know the plot. In King Lear, for instance, King Lear historically ended happily, so the audience was expecting a happy ending and, of course, got a very sad one.
Yeah. The story, of course, about a king betrayed and murdered, did it have any kind of political implication at its time? I mean, was there a larger point Shakespeare was getting at? Was he toying with the audience in that way, do you think?
Well, I think fratricide is always a major issue. I think at this point in right at the juncture between when Queen Elizabeth had died and King James had come to the throne in 1604, about the time Hamlet was being written, the audience was very concerned about the monarchy and succession. And look at this play. What's happened? Hamlet's father has died, and in primogeniture, Hamlet ought to be king. But he comes back from college, and his uncle's on the throne. Things are messed up and confused here. And so a problem for Queen Elizabeth is she didn't have an heir. Who is going to be take over when she died? And it turned out to be the son of Mary, Queen of Scots, who Elizabeth had murdered. So it's very relevant for the audience.
Mm. Do we have any idea at all how the first audiences who saw this may have reacted? I know it's so hard to sort of gather that kind of information. Do we have any sense at all how the play was regarded, thought of at the time?
Well, it was one of Shakespeare's more best-selling plays. It went through several editions in his lifetime, and that's a good judge of a play's popularity. It also gets alluded to quite a bit in both other plays and other literary work. So clearly, an audience was internalizing this, and there are lots of echoes of Hamlet around. So it may well have been one of his big successes. We know that there are certain plays like Troilus and Cressida. Didn't do very well. In fact, when it got printed, they say on the in the prologue, it was never clapper-clawed by the palms of the vulgar, meaning that it was, maybe they performed it and nobody clapped.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Marco Bertocelli, where was Shakespeare? I think you've said he was kind of at the height of his powers when he wrote this piece.
Well, I mean, that's my opinion. I mean, he wrote this piece, I think, back-to-back with Twelfth Night, which is another show I directed this summer, interestingly enough. So it was great to have an opportunity to sort of explore this period in his career. You know, it seemed to happen sort of mid-career, and, you know, there's no question about the brilliance of the play. I think the point that was made earlier is right on the money about the plots are there, but what Shakespeare really brings to it is this soaring, sumptuous language, and that's really the genius of it. And you just get the feeling that I remember talking to the actors working on this, wondering, you know, what was happening while he was sitting down. Was he tearing his hair out trying to find the word for this play, or did it just spill out of him? Did he just vomit this onto the page? And you know, we can only wonder, fantasize about what may have been really going on with him. But truly, something reached from somewhere and touched him in this moment to create arguably one of the greatest plays ever written.
Eric Rasmussen, let's talk about the considerable scholarship and discussion going on about this play. I mean, you're one of the editors I mentioned of this online collection of articles and papers written about it. You told us earlier, in fact, that anyone who thinks they have an original idea about Hamlet can come online and see that, in fact, they don't. What are people talking about with Hamlet?
Well, they're just so, I mean, and people have been talking for centuries.
Yeah.
Every year there are 500 new books and articles written about Hamlet. And so if you read a book a day, you'd only be 135 behind by the end of the year. And so there's just enormous amount of discussion and scholarship. And it's interesting. Every age seems to find a reflection of their age in Hamlet. You know, in the 60s, Hamlet was indeed the angry young man who was fighting against the establishment. In the Victorian period, he was seen as more of a sensitive wallflower. So it's fascinating to go over the history of Hamlet criticism, and we do indeed we have just about a database of all commentary on Hamlet from the 1700s through the 21st century up online now, and it's kind of fascinating to just go through an individual line and scroll through and see what people have been writing for 400 years.
You know, I keep coming to the, and a lot of people talk about this, the theme of indecision, which a lot of people take as the kind of the larger theme for the play, that, you know, that he, as Olivier famously said in the preface to his film, you know, this is a tragedy of a man who couldn't make up his mind. But certainly not everyone, we'll talk about this as we get along, the idea, go along as this idea of indecision, but not everyone agrees that's what Shakespeare was on about, I guess.
Well,
go ahead, Mark.
I think Olivier himself was a little embarrassed about having said that later in his career, put that in the film. If you look just a very basic look at the plot, I mean, this is not a man who is indecisive. I think it's hard to make that argument. He's been confronted with a ghost. He doesn't know whether this ghost is sent from heaven or hell.
Yeah.
So his first order of business is to get some confirmation that it is a good ghost, quote unquote, and it is there to tell him the truth. And so that he has, you know, regicide is a big deal. You don't just jump in and start stabbing people for revenge. So I think he needs to find that out. He doesn't really find that out until the play within the play, by observing Claudius's reaction, which he almost blows because he's very energetic. I mean, having played it myself, it's a very exhausting role physically to do. So it's not a guy just sitting there thinking things out. He's very physically involved in this world. And, you know, the final confirmation comes, I think, off stage when he pilfers a letter from Claudius that Rosencrantz and Guildenstern had on their way to England, and that is the ultimate proof. So in other words, he gets his own proof from the play within the play, but then it's another thing to convince the public that taking revenge on Claudius is the right thing to do. You can't very well kill the king and then say publicly, well, a ghost told me to do it, and I believe the ghost was correct. So he needed some further proof, if you will, before acting, and he gets that in the letter. The letter is a clear request from Claudius to have Hamlet killed when he arrives there. So
he's a rational figure, you're saying.
I'm sorry?
He's a rational figure, you're saying.
Well, he's a rational figure. Personally, as I look at the play, as I worked on the play both times as an actor and director, I didn't see a person who had trouble making up his mind. Mm-hmm. I think there were things he needed to be sure of before he went forward. I mean, after all, this is a man of action, I think. He's responsible in one way or another for the death of maybe five people in the play. So, you know, the stage is littered with dead bodies.
Right.
This is not like, you know, it's not all it's, this cerebral, contemplative person. I find him to be a very active participant.
Yeah. Eric Rasmussen, where are you on that score?
Well, I think the play is about what it's like to be an intellectual in a world that demands action. And, most famously in the To Be or Not to Be speech, Hamlet is working through that you can, you know, as you go line by line in that speech, it's almost like a flow chart. It starts out, you can be or not to be, you can live or kill yourself. If you choose to be, then you can suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or you can fight back. And if you fight back against your troubles, then two things might happen. By opposing, you might end them, or they might end you. And if they end you, then you die. But even death has two possibilities. Death could be sleep, nothing more than sleep, sleep no more. Mm. Or it could be nightmares. And it could be worse than being alive. So what he's saying in that speech is, and maybe we can play a clip or two of some of the major actors doing it.
We're going to get to that. In fact, we'll start with Olivier's rendering of that. So just talk about it in that context.
Well, as you mentioned with Olivier, for him it was a play about a man who couldn't make up his mind. And when Olivier gives this soliloquy in the film, the camera sort of spirals into his head, and you end up looking at Olivier's scalp for a great deal. The idea being clearly that we're seeing into his brain. the point of this speech is, here is Hamlet. They're demanding action of him. Go kill your uncle. Take revenge. And he said, well, wait a minute. If you're an intellectual, if you've thought through all the consequences, you might not act. Conscience doth make cowards of us all is the line. And because as someone who's thought everything through, I may not act right away. And this is particularly relevant, I think, in presidential campaign seasons. We want our leaders to be strong men of action. We don't want them to be, looking down and checking their notes. And we say that they're waffling if they're not going out there and acting. At the same time, we say if you go into war, but you haven't fought through the peace, you haven't fought through the consequences of that war, well, that's not good either. So Hamlet's right, the tension and the conflict in Hamlet is between those two poles.
Here's Laurence Olivier from the 1948 film of Hamlet. This is from Act 3.
To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing, end them. To die. To sleep no more. And by a sleep, to say we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to. It is a consummation devoutly to be wished. To die. To sleep. To sleep. A chance to dream. Aye, there's the rub. For in that sleep of death, what dreams may come when we have shuffled off this mortal coil must give us pause. There's the respect that makes calamity of so long life. For who would bear the whips and scorns of time, the oppressor's wrong, the proud man's contumely, the pangs of despised love, the law's delays, the insolence of office, and the spurns that patient merit of the unworthy takes when he himself might his quietus make with a bare bodkin.
Laurence Olivier from Hamlet. We should say that the Utah Shakespeare Festival's production of Hamlet opened last month. It runs through October 27th at the Randall Jones Theater in Cedar City. You can visit our website for details about that. Marco Baricelli is the artistic director for Shakespeare Santa Cruz. He's directing the production for the Utah Shakespeare Festival. And Eric Rasmussen is with us, an English professor, Shakespeare scholar at the University of Nevada, Reno. We need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Shakespeare's Hamlet. The Utah Shakespeare Festival is staging the play, which is giving us an opportunity to talk about it. You can join the conversation if you like. 801-585-WEST is our number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We have with us Eric Rasmussen, an English professor and Shakespeare scholar at the University of Nevada, Reno. Marco Baricelli is with us. He's the artistic director for Shakespeare Santa Cruz. He's directing the Utah Shakespeare Festival performance of Hamlet. And we're also joined by Bob Mondello. He's an arts critic for NPR, joining us today from NPR Studios in Washington. And Bob Mondello, welcome back. Thanks for
being here. Hey, Doug. It's good to be here.
I wanted to start with you, Bob. You've seen your share of productions of Hamlet. Start with this. Why does it work for you? Why does this play work for you?
Oh gosh, this is part of my my inner being at this point. I've probably seen it 36, 37 times. I love the play. Oh my God! When I was younger, it was all about me as a sort of an indecisive young guy trying to figure out what I was going to do with life. Now I look at him as this sort of kid who is trying to figure things out, and I've always sort of been fascinated with the inner turmoil, but there's a reason this is the most popular or the most profound play, I guess, in the English language. It's just an astonishing piece of work.
You've seen. I want to talk about the different performances you've seen over time, and you've you talked about you were telling us earlier that you had seen one of the weirdest you had seen was a woman playing an all-woman production of Hamlet.
A one-woman production by Dame Judith Anderson. I was a college kid. She was in her late 60s, I think, and we all thought at the end of her career, although she performed for another 20 years at least, and she was touring this one-woman Hamlet that she was taking around from college campus to college campus. And she came to mine, and I knew she was famous. My parents knew who she was. Mm. So I went to see it. And, you know, she's completely persuasive as Hamlet. And she's in her 60s, seriously. She's completely persuasive as Hamlet. She does a great Polonius. She's a wonderful Ophelia. The gravedigger scene was just fantastic. And the one part she couldn't get was Gertrude, which was the one that she should have been able to play in her sleep, right? And for some reason, she wasn't persuasive in that. But the rest of it was kind of astonishing. It's also really neat to see somebody killing herself on a stage.
Right.
It's a riot.
Well, what let's talk about the men who've played it. Do you have a favorite or one that you were particularly taken by in terms of?
Well, I've seen so many. There are a couple that I. Are you talking about stage Hamlets or all kinds?
Of all kinds, any kind.
Well, here in town, we did a silent Hamlet. A group called Cinetic Theater did it as they're sort of a movement based troupe. Mm. And they did a fascinating one that was really, I mean, it's interesting to try to do Shakespeare without the words.
Wow.
I guess the one on stage that I was kind of most taken with was one by Tom Hulse, the actor who played Amadeus in the film Amadeus.
Yeah.
And I saw him, it was probably 10, 12 years after Amadeus. And he was really a thoughtful, intellectual Hamlet. And for some reason, that just sort of worked for me at that time. On film, the Olivier one, it was interesting listening to that again because I haven't seen it in quite a while. Mm. And he feels so dramatic now.
Yeah.
The Branagh one is a much quieter one in a way. So it's interesting. Olivier at that point in his career was kind of he was bridging the great romantic tradition of acting and turning it more down to earth for film, but it's still very big, and you can hear him, sort of getting up to the big moments in the script as he's getting there.
Well, it's funny. I guess it raises the point. You know, in some ways, I hope this isn't unfair, but it seems a little cheesy now. I guess because we're at a different time. Eric Rasmussen, is this sort of what happens? People take it and adapt it to make it feel more real for their time.
Oh, exactly. And whether you're doing it in modern dress or any number of things, it becomes certainly in Olivier with the music swelling to that moment, as you say, it seems a little cheesy to us. And Bob's right that Branagh is much more sort of quiet. And Branagh does that scene in a hall of mirrors, mm-hmm. and we get it. It's a pun on reflection,
yeah.
But it's also one-way mirrors where Claudius and Polonius are on the other side, and so he can go up with his Bärbaugen, with his dagger, and it's both him looking at himself in the mirror and thinking of suicide and threatening Claudius on the other side.
Yeah.
Works really nicely.
Let's play a little moment of that, if we could. This is the to be or not to be soliloquy. This is Kenneth Branagh.
To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them, to die, to sleep no more, and by a sleep to say we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to, 'tis a consummation.
Kenneth Branagh.
Isn't he wonderful?
Yeah,
oh,
great.
My God. I get such a kick out of it. And you're also conscious when you saw how much faster that was than Olivier. And part of it is because he decided in that version he was going to use every word that had ever been put anywhere near the word Hamlet on a script someplace. And so it was over 3 hours long.
It was
an enormous thing. But they had a lot more verbiage to get through. So he was going to do it a little faster.
Marco Baricelli, you have a favorite?
A favorite Hamlet?
Yeah.
Somebody else asked me that the other day. I can't say that I have a favorite Hamlet. I'm interested in many of them. Of course, the difference between seeing a Hamlet on film and a Hamlet live on stage is enormous.
That's
and there
true.
Are different things that have to come into play. When I did it years ago at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, it was in this big open stage, the Elizabethan Theater up there in Ashland. And, so the choices that had to be made had to tend to the more muscular side of things rather than the more internal, subtle side of things, for want of a better word. You just suppose that to what you are able to do on film, as you said, this camera going right up to Olivier's head and inside of it, et cetera, et cetera, people being able to whisper and things like that. So the role of Hamlet changes with the venue And it is, changes with the person. I mean, to my mind, there is no role of Hamlet. There is only the person playing it. Hmm. And whoever Hamlet has to be, whoever that person is. And that, to me, is the brilliance of the role and the great privilege it is to play it.
I guess for me, it was one of the first that I really took any note of, and that was the Derek Jacobi version. I guess, Bob, that's the case, right? It's the one that you remember from the time you're really, really first thinking about this play, the most influence it has on you, at least for some of us.
Yeah, I was trying to think when I first saw it, and it's been forever now. But the productions I remember are usually ones that, the weirdness about seeing this play when you see it 36 or 37 times is that it still has something to give you every time, mm-hmm. and there's always some moment in a Hamlet that I think, oh, that's interesting. I remember seeing one that was set in, a Prussian period, the late 19th century, so that it was very formal. And the way you knew that Ophelia had lost her mind was that she came to the dinner table without gloves.
Wow.
And when she showed up without gloves, you thought, oh, there's something wrong. And the whole cast, of course, is sitting at the dinner table and sees her without gloves, and everybody's sort of startled. And then she started singing at the table. And, you know, I mean, I was taught by my mother, you don't sing at the table. So this was obviously a crazy lady. And it was really interesting because it allowed her to be incredibly subtle about the way she was doing things, that she could really pull inside herself, because the atmosphere that the director had created for the play, the stage ambience, was doing a lot of the work of talking about the strictures of society. And then within that, you saw how the characters were reacting to it. And I think that's the kind of thing that I get out of Hamlet's now.
Well, I remember seeing Ian McKellen in Richard III, mm-hmm. the Winter of Discontent soliloquy right at the top, getting dressed in his Nazi-like garb, and the final moment was when he puts on, because he has a withered hand, was putting on a glove with one hand.
Right. Which is a great stage trick. I saw him do it on stage.
So did I. It's amazing, actually.
It was breathtaking.
It was the best part of the play, I have to say, in some way. The audience went crazy at that moment.
Yeah.
And it makes me wonder, Marco and Eric, you too, these moments where it's not just the words, but there are opportunities on a stage or on film, I suppose, to give it another dimension, I guess.
And surely when they have to figure out a way to do the My Kingdom for a Horse line,
and with tanks,
beat it because the Jeep isn't working right.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. And Marco Baricelli, we should say, I mean, you're doing it in, I'm not sure how to describe it. It's not exactly a stylized version, but it's not, it's modern dress.
It's sort of haute couture. Yeah. And the set itself is sort of very ancient castle-like, probably 12th or 13th century castle that is slightly crumbling, but in it's peopled with people in sort of very haute couture dress, and there you know, there's no trick to that. I just, reading it over and over and over, preparing to go in, it just struck me, this juxtaposition between the very ancient and the very modern seemed to have some resonance for me, and
it wasn't a fashion shoot or anything.
No, it wasn't like that. But, you know, speaking of, you know, choices that are made, I kept reading it thinking, you know, the last thing I want to put on stage now, especially given all the movies and television effects that we go on, I thought, I don't want an actor walking on stage in a ghost costume for this. So I opted to have the ghost we used lights so that Hamlet was staring out over the audience into a blinding sort of moving light, and the ghost is a voiceover in our production.
Cool.
And it works quite well in that there's, you know, you don't have the problem of having a guy dressed up in a ghost costume, for one thing. But it also begs the question of, you know, whether this is in our head. There's a whole question of whether Bernardo and Marcellus are hearing the same thing that Hamlet is hearing, or are they just reacting to Hamlet, et cetera, et cetera. And then when the ghost appears again in the closet scene with Gertrude, again, Gertrude is clearly not seeing what Hamlet is seeing, and Hamlet himself starts to wonder about whether what he has seen is true or not, is real or not, or he is, in fact, losing his mind.
Well, which gets us to that perfect segue, Marco Baricelli. I want to talk about this idea of, was Hamlet crazy? People play him that way. Some have, anyway, thought of him that way. Certainly not entirely there. We'll talk about it when we get back from a break. Marco Baricelli is with us, artistic director for Shakespeare Santa Cruz. He directed the Utah Shakespeare Festival's performance of Hamlet. Bob Mondello is with us. He's NPR's arts critic. Eric Rasmussen is with us, English professor and Shakespeare scholar at the University of Nevada, Reno. The Shakespeare Festival's production of Hamlet opened. It's opened already. It opened last month. It runs through October 27th at the Randall L. Jones Theater in Cedar City. You can go to our website for details about that. Radio West.KUER.ORG. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The Utah Shakespeare Festival is staging Shakespeare's tragedy Hamlet. And it's giving us an opportunity today to talk about the play. We have with us the scholar Eric Rasmussen. We have Marco Baricelli, who is directing the production in Cedar City. And Bob Mondello was with us. He's NPR's arts critic. So I want to get to this question. There's a scene, and Eric Rasmussen, you've talked about the fact that how Hamlet has been played over time. You say actors used to play him as this kind of, I think you put it this way, wilted wallflower, quiet. And over time, you sort of pinpoint this to the 1960s. He becomes more, what, energetic, more volatile, even more angry?
I think certainly. And now has, as Bob Mondello was saying, has become more quiet in certain productions like Kenneth Branagh's. But then David Tennant, who was the television actor who played Doctor Who, did a very active Hamlet recently. So maybe we're going to see a string of more active Hamlets.
Let me the question we were getting to before we went to a break, is Hamlet unhinged? I want to play another moment, and Eric, maybe you can set this up for us. This is the it's referred to as the Get Thee to a Nunnery scene when he's really going after Ophelia. Talk about this, because the scene we're going to play is, or at least a part of it anyway, is Derek Jacobi. I mean, he's really intense in this.
Yeah, there's a marvelous moment in Jacobi's scene. This is one he did for the BBC television series back in 1980. And there's a moment in this speech where he's screaming at Ophelia, and I know you get thee to a nunnery. And there's a moment where he says, it has made me mad. And every Hamlet throughout history had delivered that as, it just made me crazy. And Jacobi takes a beat and has this moment of revelation where he says, it has made me mad. And it's a moment where he realizes, oh my gosh, it really has made me crazy. And so instead of it's absolutely wonderful moment of film, and then many, many Hamlets, certainly Branagh after him, have been imitating Jacobi, so it was a transformative moment.
I have heard your basic too. Whenever God has given you one face, you make yourselves another. You jig, you amble, you lisp, you nickname. God's creatures, you make your wantonness, your ignorance. Go to her, no more.
It hath made me mad. I say, we will have no more marriages. Those that are married already, all but one, shall live. The rest shall keep as they are. To a nunnery, go!
Marco Baricelli, what do you think? He thinks he's mad. Is he mad?
I love that choice. I think it's pretty terrific. You know, is he mad or isn't he mad? The whole question, you know, I will, this antic disposition, I think that's sort of where the thread starts. And but, you know, in looking at the play, there are a lot of different ways to look at it. I mean, antic was, you know, the etymology of that word actually means more antique, an older disposition, something rather than crazy. And as I look at the play, I don't see a lot of, I don't see a payoff for Hamlet in, if he is, let's say, saying to everybody, I'm going to act like I'm mad so that I can get A, B, and C. I don't see that actually paying off. I do see him sort of struggling on the edge there, as Jacoby so brilliantly portrayed, where he starts to slip back and forth and is unsure of his own sanity at a certain point. Mm. But it's a great question, and I think there are a lot of different ways to go at it.
But Bob Mundell, I guess it doesn't matter necessarily, but what do you think?
You mean it doesn't matter what I think?
No. It doesn't matter whether Hamlet was actually crazy or playing crazy. That's
well,
what
I've always assumed that he's kind of calculating at this point. But I think that's more... this is interesting. In high school, I went to the American premiere of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, Tom Stoppard's riff on Hamlet, in which Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are the central characters, and Hamlet sort of breezes in and then breezes back out. And it was fairly clear that they were being manipulated, and so I decided he was a manipulative character. And this is before I had formed my notions of Hamlet the play really strongly. And so I think I still assume that he is manipulating everybody around him, and certainly he's working at it. He isn't. It's not. He's not successful at it always. And it doesn't. I mean, you know, Mark is right. It does not end up in a good place for him. But I think he's trying to. So I've decided that he's being manipulative there rather than nuts.
Yeah, yeah. Eric Rasmussen, we're running out of time, and I want to get to this question of how this production would have been originally performed or anyway pronounced. This is one of the things you've been interested in.
Yeah, last year I produced the Hamlet in the original pronunciation, working closely with the linguist David Crystal. And the thing is, the words rhyme, and they would rhyme differently in Shakespeare's time than in our own. Famously, in Sonnet 116, it ends with the couplet, if this be error and upon me proved, I never writ nor no man ever loved. Well, that's not a couplet. Proved doesn't rhyme with loved in our pronunciation, but in Shakespeare's time it would.
Yeah.
And by doing the Hamlet in the original pronunciation, we thought we would learn things, or we went in assuming we would hear puns that weren't there before. And what we found was just fascinating. There's a line in the opening scene where Gertrude says to Hamlet, "Oh, thou knowest 'tis common, all that lives must die, passing through nature to eternity." Well, die and eternity don't rhyme in our time, but they would have in Shakespeare's. So she's saying, thou knowest lives must die, passing through nature to eternity. That's a couplet. Huh. Couplets come at the end of a speech. Here's the mother saying, look, kid, end of discussion. and you have that finale. And when we hit that, we all suddenly came up short and said, wow, that really works in a way it never did before.
So Gertrude isn't the doormat. She can be portrayed sometimes.
Exactly. It makes her a much stronger character. That makes I mean, it's kind of a fatuous thing to say to your son who's grieving for his dead father, oh, come on, kid, man up. But with that couplet, it really has a moment of power.
Mm.
I am fascinated. That's really interesting. I've always been intrigued by people. People have told me that the Alabama Shakespeare Company is doing Shakespeare in a way with the accents that sounds more Elizabethan than most other American companies that do it. And I know a bunch of people from Argentina who've come here, and they have less trouble with Shakespeare than they do with contemporary plays, because they hear they hear the language in a way that is closer to Spanish, which has always fascinated me. I mean, it is not a Romance language, obviously, but the pronunciation back in the day would have been more like tobe or not tobe.
Well, let's play an example of that particular soliloquy, as a matter of fact.
Oh, super.
This is Eric Rasmussen. This is performed by the British actor Matthew Melliu. This is an original pronunciation version of that soliloquy. We'll play a bit of it, the to be or not to be speech.
To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end 'em. To die, to sleep no more, and by a sleep to say we end a heartache and a thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to, which is a consummation devoutly to be wished. To die, to sleep perchance to dream. Aye, there's the rub. For in that sleep of death what dreams may come when we have shuffled off this mortal coil must give us pause. There's the respect that makes calamity of so long life.
You know, Eric Rasmussen, I hear there's one thing I always detected in that, and that is that in some way it sounds more colloquial, less mannered or less formal. Am I reading that right, or am I just thinking of it in the wrong context?
Exactly. And when we David Crystal worked on an original pronunciation production of Romeo and Juliet at the Globe, and they were doing it in received pronunciation for most of the run, but they did a weekend in OP. And when they did it in OP, it shaved 10 minutes off the total, because it's much faster, more colloquial. And, you know, people will hear a little bit of Irish, a little bit of Scottish, a little bit of Australian. My students hear Johnny Depp in Pirates of the Caribbean. It's just this sort of soup of languages that were in London in Shakespeare's time, and it sounds quite wonderful.
Yeah. There's a scene from later in the play. This is in Act 3, and it plays out in the Queen's bedroom in her chamber. And there's sort of two parts of this I wanted to talk about. The first is this idea of sex, you know, sexuality. I mean, there have been some who have sort of played it as really sexual. And now, keep in mind, this is Hamlet and his mother, so the Oedipal implications are there. I'm not crazy about Mel Gibson's performance here, but let me just play a little bit of it, because he really plays up the sex from his film Hamlet.
This was your husband.
Look, you now what follows. Here is your husband, like a mildewed ear, blasting his wholesome brother. Have you eyes? Could you on this fair mountain leave to feed and batten on this moor? Have you eyes? You cannot call it love, for at your age the heyday and the blood is tame, it's humble, and waits upon the judgment. And what judgment would step from this to this? Eyes without feeling, feeling without sight. Oh, shame. Where is...
I guess a lot of the sex comes through in what you see as well as what you hear, Eric Rasmussen. What do you make of the way some have played it that way and that relationship between Hamlet and his mother?
Well, I think you're right, and that's the Zeffirelli film with Mel Gibson and Glenn Close,
right,
culminating in a fairly passionate kiss, at which point the ghost of the father shows up. I hate that, you know, French kissing your mother and your dead father appears. But you're right. It's a very Oedipal kind of, and certainly over the top in that. But the interesting thing about the closet is the closet was sort of the inmost private chamber that a woman could go to, and you would have various receiving rooms where you would receive guests, and then you'd have your bedroom, which was, you know, you only share with very intimate people. And then even beyond that is the intimacy of the closet, and the fact that Hamlet is there in his mother's closet is odd to begin with.
And I guess Marco Baricelli, the other part that's interesting in that scene is the question that sort of is implied. You know, does Gertrude know? Was she having an affair with Claudius? Did she in any way help kill her husband?
Well, I'm sure people have made the argument for that. I find that a little troubling.
You don't see it that way at all.
I don't see it that way. The question that interests me is whether Polonius had any hand in it.
Wow.
And there are a lot of indications to me that, you know, it's certainly a case can be made for that. So, you know, and the closet scene is one example. It's very interesting that Claudius allows Polonius to go hide and overhear this scene, knowing full well that Hamlet may start saying things about the murder of Hamlet Sr. And the sexual, you know, this Oedipal thing that you're talking about, that's also implicit, I think, a little bit in Olivier's film. I think, you know, it comes and goes depending on, Nicole Williamson's version has incestuous sort of implications going on between Laertes and Ophelia. So I think, you know, it just people pick and choose what they're interested in, what's going on at the time, you know, in psychology, pop psychology, et cetera. It tends to inform this, their versions of this play.
Bob Mondello, let me give you the final word, about 30 seconds left. Pretty relevant still? You think we're in the middle of a political campaign, of course.
Well, Eric already talked about that. Yeah. Absolutely. This is there's a reason I can watch it as many times as I have and still look forward to it every time. There is always something you can learn from this play. Shakespeare put everything into it in ways that he didn't to a lot of his other plays. And I think, yes, you can. After seeing this, I see the debates differently. I see machinations and political machinations especially differently. You can't help it.
NPR's Bob Mondello, Eric Rasmussen joined us, Marco Baricelli. Thank you all very much for being with us. We should mention the Shakespeare Festival's production of Hamlet is running through October 27th. Go to our website for details about that. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.